While the 10th anniversary of September 11th dominated the headlines this week, there was, in fact, other news, including today, with the sentencing of former Massachusetts House Speaker Sal DeMasi to 8 years in prison.
His co-defendant Richard McDonough received 7 years. WBUR's David Boeri was there.
Both DeMasi and McDonough and their families in the front row showed no emotion. It seemed as if they were expecting this.
Meanwhile, last night, President Barack Obama laid out his $447 billion jobs plan. But that's just the first step, as Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano put it.
Now the question is, of course, whether the Republicans will even consider cooperating and trying to compromise with us. And the next question is whether the president will stand up and fight for the things he just laid forth.
Well, joining us now to review the week's news is Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here again.
And David Bernstein, political reporter for the Boston Phoenix. Hi there, David.
Good to see you.
So let's start off with the sentencing of Speaker of the House, Sal DeMasi. I mean, back in June, he was found guilty of crimes related to receiving kickbacks in exchange for using his power on Beacon Hill to shepherd some lucrative state contracts through the legislature. Now, the prosecution had suggested 12 and a half years, but DeMasi's defense wanted three. Judge Wolf went right down the middle with eight. And Joan Vinaki, you were there at the sentencing in the federal courthouse today. What was it like when the sentence was handed down?
Well, I think by the time it was handed down, it almost felt a little bit anticlimactic. And I'm guessing that for DeMasi and his family, you know, they might have been thinking it could have been worse. You know, 8 years is less than 12. It was an interesting moment, though, because when the former speaker stood for the sentencing, that was about 11:40 a.m. 20 minutes later, Judge Wolf was still talking. He, you know, really lectured DeMasi. He talked about the good things that he'd done in his life, but he, you know, also said that he represented the American dream corrupted, which are, you know, pretty tough words, I think.
David?
Well, you know, Judge Wolf is a very, very careful and thorough judge, and he has made clear in the past that he thinks that white-collar crime is sort of treated disproportionately easily by our system than street crime. And it was interesting to watch this case, sort of wondering what he would do. You know, would he go for a very harsh sentence to sort of make that point? And it seemed like he was trying. I was not there in the courtroom, but it seemed like he was sort of trying to make the case for harsh punishment for this kind of crime, while at the same time sort of acknowledging that he can't go too far against precedent by giving him, you know, 16 years or something.
Well, right. He actually mentioned the fact that the lighter sentences, or the not, you know, basically non-existent sentences that the two former speakers received, worked in Sal DeMasi's favor, because to have gone really, really hard on DeMasi would have created, he said, a disparity that could look unfair. So, you know, as David just said, you know, precedent in a way did help Sal DeMasi.
Precedent did help him.
I believe so, yes.
Okay, because I found it kind of interesting that I was wondered if it was Sal DeMasi's bad luck that he got Judge Wolf, given that his two predecessors, speakers of the House, former Thomas Finneran and Charles Flaherty, never, you know, they were both indicted but never actually stepped foot in a jail.
This was a whole different set of circumstances. This is a very different sort of thing. The U.S. attorney was not going to allow DeMasi to get out of this without some significant prison time, and so they were not going to make any kind of deal with him that didn't involve that. And the one thing that I would say that and I've heard this from others, including Dave Boeri, who you played earlier, I've talked to, who agrees with me that if DeMasi got bad luck in getting Judge Wolf, it was because Judge Wolf was someone who could actually pull off a trial like this without leaving it very open to to a hung jury, mm-hmm. or to appeal. He was very, very thorough and careful, and it's going to be very hard, I think, for DeMasi to challenge it.
And I would just quickly add that it does seem like it's a really personal cause for Judge Wolf, and I don't mean that in a bad way. He seemed really offended by the letters from Beacon Hill Paul's that he received on behalf of DeMacy.
Asking the court for mercy, essentially.
It was more, to him, it seemed like it was more proof that people still don't get it, and that really seemed to offend him.
Well, on that point, Joan, I mean, I guess the thing that everyone's wondering is, are people on Beacon Hill going to get it now? Has the message been sent, and that maybe this could be the seed that really gets complete reform going on Beacon Hill?
Well, I hate to predict what Beacon Hill, but I don't think they really get it. And even Sal DeMacy, the other thing that Judge Wolf kept on noting was he didn't really show contrition in his own statement. I'm not sure Sal DeMacy gets it.
David?
Yeah, I have to agree with Joan on that. It's fascinating to see DeMacy's statement, which essentially he had a phrase in there to the effect of the road good intentions road to prison. He paraphrased, but with good intentions. And I was like, what is the good intention that was involved? What do you think your good intention was of taking
good intention,
kickbacks?
Right, helping his friends and helping himself.
I don't know about Joan's email inbox, but mine has not been flooded with statements from Massachusetts polls congratulating the judge on giving an effective sentence. I have not heard a peep out of anyone from Beacon Hill. And we saw when the conviction came, all we heard from them was this should not be any reflection on anything else that goes on here in Beacon Hill. So I don't see much changing.
Well, maybe it's because their minds might now be focused on what once was Sal DeMacy's nemesis in terms of legislation, and that's casinos. But that's for another week. I promise I won't bring it up today, because let's actually turn to something that's even more pressing probably on the minds of most listeners, and that is jobs, because President Barack Obama gave his long-anticipated job speech last night. He proposed a $447 billion jobs plan, included spending for an infrastructure bank, including including transportation and schools. He suggested some cuts as well. Let's just listen to a little bit of Mr. Obama.
The question is whether, in the face of an ongoing national crisis, we can stop the political circus and actually do something to help the economy.
So, David Bernstein, it seems that the proposal is more than half of the stimulus package, but it also includes elements that seem to be designed to appeal to the Republican Party. I mean, your overall take on the efficacy of this approach that the president's taking?
Well, you have to look at the economic efficacy and the political efficacy. And if you work under the assumption that nothing that President Obama offers is going to pass anyway, then it's really more about the political efficacy. And what he's trying to do, I think, is put forward a proposal that looks very, very reasonable and will look very unreasonable when the Republicans nix it. And so it's going to be on the Republicans to either try to go along with it, find a way to go along with it, but more likely to try to say no in a way that doesn't make them look bad. So, some sort of counter proposal or whatever it might be.
Joan, your thoughts on that?
Well, I'd like to start out by saying I thought it was a well-delivered speech, and that for the first time in a few weeks he actually looked like he had a pulse, which is a good thing. The plea about stopping the political circus, I probably have the same response to that I have to, will things change on Beacon Hill? It's really hard to stop the political circus. Although the initial reaction from Republicans, they did seem, not as, that they were taking it easy. They weren't jumping all over it. They were saying there were things that were worth considering, which shows that they've learned something from that whole debt ceiling circus as well.
Well, let me ask you about one particular Republican, and that's Senator Scott Brown, who I believe I saw standing up and clapping for the president at times where nobody else in his party was doing that. I mean, how does that strike you?
Well, that strikes me as if he were, looking for the TV cameras in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I think Scott Brown will be very much hoping that nothing ever comes out of the House and gets over to the Senate side so that he can...
That he actually has to vote on.
Exactly. So he can make comments to the effect of, I really like these specific parts of the bill, without saying I would vote yes or no on the entire bill. And I think that he'll... he'll pick and choose exactly what he favors on it.
Well, in the last minute that we have, I mean, obviously we've had both of you on this program many times to talk about the Week in Review, and the biggest week of news of the week is September 11th. So I just want to briefly hear from both of you, you know, A, where were you on that day 10 years ago, and your thoughts on where Boston and Massachusetts finds itself a decade later. David?
Well, I was actually, I was a freelance writer at the time. I was working at home, and my wife actually called me from work to say that this crazy thing was on the news. And I, you know, turned it on in time to see the aftermath and then the second plane and everything, and watched it all from home. I think that Boston, a lot of things have gotten back to normal in a sense in Boston, but we keep getting reminded every once in a while of, hey, it was about us too. You know, we were part of this mm-hmm. situation, and little things tend to remind me of that in kind of odd ways, and it's a little eerie.
Joan?
Well, I'll say two quick things. I was also at home getting ready to go to work. I had the television on, and I saw the towers collapse. I called my parents who were in New York, you know, and did what, you know, millions of other people did. I remember actually crying over the phone to my dad. And the second thing I did that my children remember, you know, they're now 22 and 18, I was there when they got home from school.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, the journalist in me, did something that other mothers might not have done. I had them watch it.
Well, Joan Vernachy, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
And David Bernstein, political writer for the Boston Phoenix, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, teaching 9/11. Across the city and around the country, schools are already incorporating 9/11 lessons into their curricula. So what are those lessons and how should they be taught? I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.